an old-time decoration day. We couldn't move the old fellow, Tom. He's as obstinate as a mule. I didn't think you could get him. He isn't that kind. So much the worse for him. We've been up to his place twice today. We offered him a good position and promised him protection, but he never answered a word. I'm sorry for the old man, but tomorrow he'll have to take the oath or swing for it. He'll swing then, for he'll never take it. I know Judge Williams. He's got his mind made up, and that's the end of it. Well, it's his own choice. He has nobody to blame but himself. The speaker turned and left the two boys with whom he had been talking. He was a sergeant serving under Tarleton, who had dispatched a band of 100 men to scour that portion of South Carolina in which they then were in the summer of 1780, and drive out the Whigs, or compel them to take the oath of allegiance to the British king. They had encamped for the night under the shelter of a hill, on the summit of which was the home of Judge Williams, a stalwart Whig, and their two visits to him that afternoon had not availed to shake the old man's resolution. The two boys to whom the young sergeant had been relating the story of their fruitless attempts to change the purpose of the judge were Tom Crowell and John Blake. Tom's mother was a widow, and when a detachment of Tarleton's men had stopped at her home on the preceding day and offered him his choice between leaving the country or joining their band, one look at the children and one thought of the suffering which his mother might be compelled to undergo had decided him, forgetting loyalty to country for the sake of his mother and the children, he had yielded. A similar offer to his friend and neighbor, John Blake, had made him yield also, and much against their wills, the two boys found themselves serving under the British flag. They were not given much liberty, however, and soon saw they were regarded with suspicion, in spite of the oath they had taken. "I say, John," said Tom, soon after the interview with the sergeant, when both boys lay wrapped in their blankets on the ground, "I wish we'd done as Judge Williams has. That's what my sister Nancy wanted me to do all the time." "We couldn't help it," replied John. "What could two boys only 18 years old do, I'd like to know?" "Oh, we had to do it, I reckon. Still, somehow I wish we hadn't. I wonder what the judge will do now." "Shh," whispered John. "Here comes the guard." And both became silent and were soon asleep. Meanwhile, Judge Williams was doing his utmost to answer Tom's question. He fully realized that the morrow would see the matter decided, and he knew too much about the sufferings of his Whig neighbors to be long in doubt as to what would happen to himself. The energetic old man promptly decided that it would be better for him to act than to leave it all with Tarleton's men, and accordingly, soon after sunset, he sent his faithful servants in every direction to summon those of his neighbors upon whom he knew he could rely. Slowly the men began to assemble at his home. They came singly, or by twos or threes, and every man had his flintlock. A whispered word from the judge explained the purpose of the call, and a decided nod was the reply of each as he took his seat and waited in silence. By midnight, 25 men were there. An hour later, 5 more had arrived. They waited another hour. Then, as only 3 more had come, the judge decided that it was time for action. 33 men against 100. What could they hope to do? No time was allowed for thinking of such problems, however, and the determined band passed silently out into the darkness. Not a word was spoken except by the leader, and like moving shadows, they advanced slowly down the hill towards the camp of Captain Eddy. There were faint streaks of light in the eastern sky when they halted and crept forward on their hands and knees to within a few yards of Tarleton's men. Then, at a signal from the leader, they all arose and stood together, waiting for the final word. The gray of the dawn had already appeared. They could discern the forms of the guards as they paced back and forth near the camp, and also the outlines of the tents. "Already," said the judge in a low voice. "Now then!" A shout from the united band broke in upon the stillness of the early morning. There was a swift rush forward, and the calls and cries were redoubled. To the startled band in the camp, it seemed as if howling enemies were on every side of them. They leaped to their feet and made a rush for their guns. Before these could be reached, however, a volley rang out. The startled men no longer sought their guns. They darted into the woods in every direction, intent now only upon their own safety. But not all went. There were cries and groans, and many fell to the ground. "Are you hit, Tom?" said John. The boys had been startled with the others at the first alarm, and crouching low had begun to run from the camp. "No," replied Tom. "Are you?" "No. Drop to the ground. Pretend you're hit. Maybe we can get away. Quick, lie on your face." And in a moment both fell prostrate on the ground and lay still. Over them swept pursuers and pursued. Others lay on the ground close by, but with them there was no deceit. Some were groaning or crying. Some would never speak again. Above all sounded the shouts of the soldiers farther and farther away. For half an hour the boys did not move, even to raise their heads. Someone might be watching, and the slightest sign might mean for them a real, not a feigned, death. But at last Tom heard a party approaching. Slowly he turned his head. Yes, there they were, a dozen, at least, and he thought they wore no uniforms. It must be the attacking party were now returning. So thought Tom, and quickly standing upright, he called to his companion, "Come on, John, we're all right now. They've driven the Tories off, and we're among friends again." Suddenly he stopped and looked in confusion at the men before him. He had made a mistake. They were not the men who had made the attack. There was the young sergeant, and beside him were some of Tarleton's men, whom he recognized at once. In confusion, he was about to turn and run when he was suddenly surrounded, and before he could offer any resistance, his hands and feet were securely bound, and he was thrown heavily upon the ground. John was served in a similar manner. Then the young officer said, "Yes, you're among friends. You are, indeed. We'll do you a friendly turn, we will. You young rascals, probably you helped set this party on us. They scattered us a bit, but we've got together again now, and they're the ones that are running. As soon as Captain Eddy comes, we'll attend to you fellows." John made no reply. What could he say? He knew only too well what in all probability was before him. Tom was silent too, and with hopeless eyes they looked about them in their despair. Hark! Someone was coming. Tom looked up and saw Captain Eddy and a band of his men. Their faces were flushed, and as they came into the camp, the boy could see that the leader was almost beside himself with rage. The young sergeant stepped up to the captain and spoke a few words which Tom could not hear, but there was no doubt about their effect. Suddenly Captain Eddy turned and, approaching the prostrate boy, said, "They did they? String 'em up! String 'em up on the first tree!" In a moment the boys were lifted from the ground and carried by the angry men to a tree by the roadside, the captain leading the way. There they halted. 2 days afterwards, an old man, bent and gray and marked by suffering, crept up to the door of Mistress Crowell's home and rapped. "My good woman," he began when the door was opened. "Mercy on us," exclaimed the woman. "It's Judge Williams." "I was Judge Williams once. Now I'm an outcast. I've been in the woods 2 days and 2 nights. This morning I came out, and there, hanging from a long limb which reached out over the road, were 2 bodies. The woman was gazing at him now with an expression of agony on her face. She tried to speak, but the words would not come. "Was one of them Tom?" It was Nancy, Tom's sister, who was speaking, and her voice was low and firm. "Yes," replied the judge softly. "I thought you ought to know." "I'm going there," said Nancy firmly. "No, no," interrupted the judge quickly. "There's a placard warning everyone against cutting him down or giving him a Christian burial. Oh, it's horrible, horrible. Were ever such villains on earth before?" I'm going there, repeated Nancy quietly. Come, Betty. You come with me. Mother, you'd better lie down while I'm gone. I'll be back soon. The judge stopped as he entered the road and watched Nancy and her younger sister as they passed out of sight. On went the girls, neither of them speaking, until at last they came in sight of something that caused them both to stop. A sob which Nancy could not check escaped her, and she covered her face with her hands. "I'm afraid, Nancy," whispered Betty. "Let's go home." "No," replied Nancy firmly. "We'll go on now." The resolute girl went through her terrible task almost unaided. A shallow grave just within the borders of the forest was dug, and there both of the young soldiers were laid for their final rest. "Where are you going now, Nancy?" inquired Betty when, after their return to the house, Nancy started forth again. "I'm going there with these." She held up two little flags, which one of Sumter's men had given her not long before. Flags were scarce in those days, and Nancy had prized them the more highly because of that fact. She would put these to a good use. The head of each grave was soon surmounted by a tiny flag. A wreath of wild summer roses was made and reverently placed on each mound. Then, satisfied that her duty was done, Nancy stepped out onto the road to return. "Nancy, there's a red coat," whispered Betty, pulling at her sister's dress. Nancy glanced up and saw a soldier standing before her. Without doubt, he had been watching her all the time, and as she thought of the warning of the placard, her face grew pale. "What have you been doing?" asked the soldier. "Decorating the graves of my brother and his friend, whom you hung." He looked at her a moment in silence, then, turning, left her without a word. And Nancy, never knowing that she had just been doing a deed which almost 100 years later the new nation would take up and make a national custom, also turned, and in silence sought her home to comfort her heartbroken mother.